Okay. First of all, what I want to share with you is I don't know if any of you could hear the music or was listening to it, but a very dear friend of mine, Jimmy Free, is this incredible violinist, and he even had a special violin made for himself that is a 7-string violin. And this is one of his CDs, and he's local, and I've even put cards of his out there if you want to find out like where he's playing and where you can get some of his music. I'm just really supporting his work.
Well, I need to know how many strings of the violin you
play. 4. Yeah. the one I'm learning on has 4. And the cats have only recently decided to stay in the same room with me when I'm practicing, so if that tells you anything. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to open with this prayer. This is by Ernest Holmes. If any of you are familiar with Religious Science or Science of Mind, which was way back, almost at the beginning of the 19th century, or 1900s, he was a pretty phenomenal person and way ahead of his time. The peace of God is at the center of my being. I am conscious of his presence. I enter into this peace and am surrounded by this peace. This peace moves out from me in all directions. It calms the troubled waters of my experience. It heals everything it contacts. There is nothing but peace. I rejoice in it. I permit it to enter my soul, to fill me with calm, to inspire me with confidence. I know that this peace goes before me and makes perfect, plain, and straight my way. Let's see, where are we going? We're going to do meditation first. And it's a silent meditation. I usually do a silent meditation. I've occasionally done a guided one, but I'm not prepared to do a guided one tonight. So you're welcome to sit anywhere on the roof. So a lot of people like to sit on the floor, up against a wall, just to be more comfortable. Totally up to you. Some of the ways you can practice getting into that quiet space is to focus on your breath. We're going to do it for 15 minutes. So I know that seems like an eternity for some and a warm-up only for others. And you know, it is what it is. And take care of yourself through it. If it gets uncomfortable, get up, move around, walk out, come back in when we're done. You know, be comfortable. That's the most important part. What I have people do first is to pay attention to their breath. Get focused on your breath. And what I mean by that is pay attention to, are you inhaling or exhaling? And use that as a mantra. In your mind, just say the word inhale. Say the word exhale in your mind. You know, ride your breath like a wave and stay focused on that. Other ways you can play with it is pay attention to your senses. You can look around and notice things with your eyes, color, depth, texture, all that stuff. And close your eyes, pay attention to sound and the layers of sound as it gets quieter. Also, you can pretend that you're like that cat waiting for the mouse coming out of the mouse hole, only you're waiting for the next thought, and that generally works pretty good. The discipline there is staying focused on waiting for the next thought. And then I'm gonna play the bowl to start us, and I'll play the bowl to let you know when the 15 minutes are up. Okay? Thank you. tonight's topic, letting go, or are you struggling with letting go? sort of morphed out of last time's, 2 weeks ago's session on unconditional love and forgiveness, because I really think that in talking with a lot of people since then, the thing that I noticed that kept coming up over and over and over was the struggle with, okay, I want to forgive and I want to let go because I intellectually understand I'm the one that feels better as a result of that. But it keeps coming back around. I'll see that person, or I'll think of something will trigger. I'll see something on TV, or I'll hear the song they liked on the radio, or, you know, and here comes all those feelings again. So it just seemed to come up that this was an important topic that we may even spend a few weeks on, who knows. but I found this, and out of Dan Millman's The Laws of Spirit, for any of you that are familiar with his work, and this one is the law of surrender, embracing a higher will. Surrender means accepting this moment, this body, and this life with open arms. Surrender involves getting out of your own way and living in accord with a higher will, expressed as the wisdom of the heart. Far more than passive acceptance, surrender uses every challenge as a means of spiritual growth and expanded awareness. And it truly is, I really think surrender does break us more open through the challenges that we face in our life, the things that, you know, break our heart, the things that piss us off, the things that scare us, right down to the little things that irritate us about somebody else's behavior, you know? And I always go back to the idea of driving in traffic as your way of looking at, do you have struggles there? 'Cause that seemed to be one of the last places that I could get any kind of handle on. I mean, and yeah. And I can always tell when I'm too tired and I'm too hungry, because I'm there in a heartbeat, you know. Only now I have to laugh at myself, because I know that all the, you know, crap that I'm dishing out to the other driver, you know, I hear the little voice in my head say, and you know they can't hear a word of this, right? It's like, yeah, okay, there is that. So, you know, what is letting go? You know, for those folks that are in 12-step programs, you know, we hear about it. The third step is all about letting go. And people who aren't in third step but have been raised in, you know, various forms of Christianity and other religions, all the master religions, all the 12 major religions, all talk about that need, that necessity for surrender, for letting go. And to me, the two are synonymous. They're the same thing. So you'll hear me go back and forth between the two tonight, and they really are the same thing for me. People I know struggle with the word surrender because they think it means giving up, raising the white flag, I give, you know, crying uncle, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I came to understand that it means none of that. I mean, even Dan Millman said in there that it's not about passive acceptance. You've heard me talk in here about non-judgment, non-attachment, and non-resistance. And when we looked at non-resistance, that non-resistance didn't mean we just sat there and just went, okay, I guess this is the way it is, you know? And I know people in the programs that have used that, and I really believe it was to the best of their ability, it was the way they were understanding it, okay? But they used that letting go, that surrendering, that it's not my business, it's God's business, to not take any action in their life. And that is not what that means. To surrender, to let go, really does mean full-on acceptance of what is in this moment. So let's break down, what does a moment mean? A moment is a microsecond. It's less than a blink of an eye. And look at how many gajillion billion moments we have in just one day, let alone a week, a month, a year, a lifetime, whatever that is for each of us. So in this moment right now, I accept that I am sitting on a table and there's no cushion under my butt. And I could have had one. I could use that, I suppose. It felt funny, so I didn't want to do that. You know, bottom line is, acceptance is you're sitting in a chair, you're in a room in a church. It's really cold outside. It's not freezing, you know, like maybe the way some people perceive it. And to also go in, and I'm going to invite you. I did this when I did a healing thing for Circle one Wednesday, and I did a guided meditation with that. And part of what I did with that one was that the idea was to embrace whatever pain, discomfort, irritation that you might be experiencing physically. So when it means to accept this body in this moment, accept this body as it is, you know, with its flaws, its weaknesses, its lack of quote-unquote beauty according to whatever the culture standards are today, just full-on acceptance. So does that mean that I don't do anything? If I have, say, a hip problem and it's been going on for a long time and the pain, I know, I can honestly say, yeah, it's getting worse, it's increasing, it's, you know, becoming more of an issue, I'm having a harder time getting around, especially in the morning when I first get up, blah, 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 whatever it is. So does that mean I do nothing? No. But in each moment, I accept what is in that moment, which means we have to stay present, right? And that's no easy task. Because in this culture, we're taught to get up in our heads and get focused on a goal and get on with it. And that's all that matters. That's all, the only thing that matters. And yet, how many people are starting to wake up and ask, is this all there is? You know, and that's after they've achieved. That's after they've gotten the education, gotten the job, made the money, bought the house, done the this, done the that. I know people in AA, for me, that have gained and lost fortune several times. You know? And everything is impermanent. Everything. There's no permanence to anything, including this meat suit that we walk around in. Just a vehicle. So acceptance and non-resistance is a letting go of the way I think things should be. in this moment. It's a letting go. It's a surrendering into... Byron Katie refers to God as reality. You know, reality is, it's cold outside. So I can go out there and complain about how cold it is, and my lack of acceptance gives me a level of stress and an inability to be, I'm totally not in the moment, I can't be present, and the ego is in full charge. And that's what the ego's job is, by the way, is to stay in the past or the future, because it can't exist in present moment. It just does not exist in present moment. So it will do anything. It'll complain about anything. And if you notice, that's how a lot of people interact and interrelate with each other. I remember working at my first treatment center. This was 100 years ago. And the thing to do was to go into the coffee room and bitch, moan, and complain. I mean, that's what everybody did. And supposedly, we were all in recovery. You know, which meant working the steps, which included the first three steps, you know, accepting, you know, powerlessness and unmanageability and you know, believing that there was something bigger than me. I can't be my own higher power. Every time I do that, I get a really big doo-doo, you know. And then turning it over, letting go, surrendering. And, you know, that just... And I remember one day sitting there at the table, and I was right in there with him. I was one of the best ones at it. And all of a sudden stopping in mid-sentence, because it just kind of hit me. I had that moment of clarity. And we get lots of those, by the way. But I had that moment of clarity that was like, what the hell are you doing? You're clean and sober. You have a job. You found awesome childcare for your son. You have gas in your car, so you didn't have to walk here. You ate breakfast. You have lunch in the fridge. I mean, all of a sudden, I began to realize that gratitude was more than just saying thank you to somebody that did something nice for you, or occasionally thinking about, yeah, I've got a job and I have a car and nah, you know. Because for our culture, most of us are used to having that, and we take it for granted. Do a little traveling in some third world countries. Hell, all you got to do is hit some of the poor areas of Vancouver. You don't even have to go to Portland. And gratitude starts to become a whole different thing. That gratitude is what I was talking about last time when I was talking about forgiveness, and how forgiveness, I really believe, is gratitude in action. Gratitude that whatever it was that person did or didn't do, according to the way I think things should have gone, is that challenge, you know, and that surrender is the opportunity to get challenge after challenge after challenge. And it might be with things, it might be with, you know, my computer, my laptop, that... Oh yeah, that one is right along with traffic. I still will struggle with that and have to remind myself it's an inanimate object, Karen. It can't hear you. But see, I think there's this other little voice in me that goes, yeah, that's not true either, yeah. It can hear me. It understands. Because sometimes I say the right combination of things, and all of a sudden it works. But I've also discovered if I don't say anything the same amount of time, it eventually will work anyway. It's just having a slow moment, and I have lots of those. So gratitude, if it's a part of surrender and letting go, where then are you just taking things for granted? then are you missing the joy that you really could be experiencing when you delight in the way the light dances in through the living room in the morning when you open the blinds? Or, I used to get really pissed off when, you know, the sunlight would hit the living room at a certain angle in the afternoon, and I'd see where all the dust was. And I would just go, oh, man. And I see that so differently now. One of the things that I know that, come on in. One of the things I know can bring us real clear into this moment and get us present and get us grateful, but then it always wears off if we don't stay present. And that is some type of what we would judge as a tragedy. Death of a family member. I remember in 2001, 9/11, when that happened, you know, I heard a lot of talk about gratitude and being in this moment and how important it was to let everyone that you love, to let them know you love them. And people were, you know, a lot of people were having a really tough time getting their mind around what had happened, and so I sort of ended up with a lot of these spontaneous gatherings of people at my house every night for a while, actually. And it was really kind of an incredible experience because what I got to watch unfold was people's process in not only getting their mind around it, but then the mind, the ego, the thinking, determining what different things meant. So this happened, and the good reason was now everybody's going to be grateful and be loving. And I wasn't saying much. I was just listening a lot. And at one point, somebody asked me, "Don't you think that's true, Karen? Everybody's going to be a lot more grateful and a lot more loving." And I said, "Yeah, for a few months. Probably till about the bills roll in for the holidays in January." Yeah. And they thought I was very cold and very calloused, and not everybody, but said, "God, how can you think that? I mean, look what's happened." And I said, "Yeah, I know, but we got woke up and we're going to go right back to sleep. Just watch. All we need to have is patience, and time will go by," and sure enough, that's what happened. In fact, I think it pretty much was done by holidays. Everybody dove into the holidays as a way to try and forget what was going on. So I think that can be true on an individual level. Just, I want you to think for a moment, and some of you may not have had this experience yet, but if you've lost a loved one to death, and let's even make it a tragedy. Let's move away from it's a person who's elderly, say in their 90s, and they've died from heart failure in their sleep. There's feelings that go with that. I'm not excluding that, and I'm not minimizing it. I'm saying the sudden death of someone when it's unexpected. If you can think about that, it might be a friend in a 12-step meeting, it might be a family member, it might have been a dear friend of yours. And when you think about that, can you remember how all of a sudden everything felt really clear and crisp? You were aware of everything. Too much so, it felt like. It almost felt sharp. It could have an edge to it. Like, how can I keep going on? How can I get up and go to work when this person's not even here anymore? And what happens, I believe, is that instead of staying with that, instead of using that as a way to surrender more, instead of using that experience that breaks us open to more self-realization, more connection with ourselves, it becomes too overwhelming for us, well, for the ego, okay, the mind, I'm going to use Tolle's language, and the ego is going to do everything it can to medicate, to get us out of that sharp relief, that sharp clarity, to get us out of present moment. So all the addictions, and I mean, there's tons of addictions. Substances are very few. Substances on the list of addictions are in the minority. So, yeah, there's alcohol, there's over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs, street drugs, there's nicotine, there's caffeine, there's food, and then you break it down in categories because different people are addicted to different types of food, like some to sugar and some to just any simple carbohydrate, and those are substances. We have to ingest those. But there's a whole lot of process addictions, and those are the ones, and I don't know anybody that doesn't have, or has, or at least has had, several addictions. Several, not just one. There's usually a main one, and then there's some minor ones. Those are the fallbacks when the major one's not available. And that can be anything from television to the internet, to work addiction, busy addiction, exercise addiction, sex addiction, gambling, money. And money breaks down in several. You can be a miser, be addicted to misering money, and be addicted to spending money. And then there are those that are addicted to literally bouncing back and forth. They go way over to this extreme, and then the guilt or the shame, whatever, starts to really nail them, and so then they bounce way over here, and they start to clamping down, and they stay clamped down. And any time where it's a clamping down and a constriction of and a holding back, like in eating disorders, anorexia is a form of food addiction, but it's controlled, so it's referred to as acting in, whereas compulsive overeating is acting out. So misering would be acting in, overspending is acting out. And there's all forms of that. And I just named a few of the addictions. Adrenaline. You know any adrenaline junkies? They love jumping out of perfectly good airplanes and bungee jumping. And I have to admit, there's a little part of me that tends to go there, but... But what I talk about an addiction, I mean, obviously, going for something like that is one thing, and it's fun. I mean, should we come up with, well, we should never do stuff like that? No, we're here to do that stuff. I believe that's part of why we're in this third dimensional reality, to play with all that. It's when it becomes the focus of everything. When it begins to harm my relationships, and when it begins to harm me. And when it shuts me out from myself and keeps me out of present moment all the time. Because that's what I have to focus on. And the ego loves that. The ego absolutely loves that because then it gets to survive.
Could you count among those like toxic relationships?
Oh, absolutely. Love addiction, avoidance, love avoidance addiction. There's relationship addiction where love and avoidance really isn't a part of it. You just, the person that is addicted to having to be in a relationship, they've got one going on the back burner if this one feels like it's about ready to fizzle out.
Why does the ego love that?
Because it keeps it at a present moment. Present moment, the ego cannot exist in. It doesn't exist in present moment. So it will always stay in past or future in one form or another. And if you look at, if you want to break that down, past is about fear, or past is about regret and remorse, and I wish, and it should have been, and being grumpy and complaining and having resentments and not being able to let go in those arenas. And future stuff is fear, anxiety, I got to get this taken care of, I have this list of to-do things and I've got to have them done by the end of the day. Well, just having that thought has me at a present moment. I have no acceptance of what's going on right now. Right now, yes, I have this list and it's there when I need to refer to it. And I'm doing one of the things on that list, and that's all that matters right now. Oh no, that's not true at all. The ego feeds off the pain body.
So, are we born with ego, or is it something that we develop because of our surroundings?
I don't believe we're born with ego. I do believe, and again, this is where I want to preface, these are my beliefs, and I don't want anyone to ever feel like I think anybody should think the way I do, because it gets a little crazy up here anyway, so I wouldn't recommend it. But aside from that, when I share these ideas, when I share my beliefs and what for me are truths, what I invite you to do is to research. Check it out for yourself. Find out, does this fit for me? I don't believe there's one path. Is what I was going to say.
I think that from my reading, ego begins when you start comparing. You notice
the separation. Yeah, the separation. And part of that for me also includes the fact that we come to this third dimensional reality to play, to experience ourselves, for God to experience itself as itself. And so we're all just little fragments of that hologram. So what was it, last weekend or the weekend before? I think it was the weekend before I taught the archetypes and sacred contracts and how we bring in 12 archetypes to work with in each physical lifetime. And so that's about developing, you know, so it's almost like from the beginning we make a contract and know we're going to move into ego because there is going to be that recognition of separation. You know, at some point a child will, there's a developmental stage and it happens actually the most in adolescence. In adolescence, in fact, that's to me the toughest developmental stage for the human being because adolescence is doing three tasks. One, to identify self. Who am I? Two, to identify sexually. So even if I'm a girl and I know that I'm attracted to boys, how do I do femininity? How does that work for me? You know, I see, you know, Susie over there all dressed in lace and frills and I don't like it. So how do I do femininity? So that's another job. And then the third job is separation from parents. I am not them. Who am I away from them? But you're right, Tom, that begins long before that when a child begins to recognize that they're separate. Babies don't. Babies have no idea that they're not an extension of everything around them. So, and I really believe that that's part of why we come here, is to go through that unconsciousness, to go through the experience of developing this ego, and some obviously develop it a lot more. It's more finely tuned. So it becomes tougher. Is it hopeless? I believe where there's breath, there's hope. That's just my belief on that. So that getting back to surrender and letting go in that process is, there's a part of, the best way to say it would be the ego, the mind, is going to fight that. It doesn't want surrender, because surrender puts us in this moment, puts us present, which it can't exist in. So it's like all the teachers I've ever learned from, they, you know, what I've heard across the board is, you know, you don't fight the ego, that's resistance. You're not going to win. Every time, it will win. So get into present moment, it simply doesn't exist.
I don't think they fall back and forth.
Well, you'd have to ask them. You know, I've known severely handicapped people that seemed happy, but they were also lost in their head and their thoughts, and, you know, their ego was running amok in different ways. And I've known severely physically handicapped people to be totally present. They had total acceptance. What you're talking about, though, Bobby, with the rock climber, with the race car driver, with a motorcycle through windy roads. Tolle talks about that, and so does Don Miguel Ruiz in one of his books, where that they're going for the rush of the adrenaline. At the same time, it's the only way they truly can experience being in present moment. So they have to be doing that activity in order to be present, because they're somehow, their brain gets wired that this is the only way I can get there. And you hear people talk about it, they might talk about it as being present, but they're also going to talk about it, I've heard it described as, that's when I totally can let go of everything. I don't think about anything. You hear about singers, and that was, well, when I used to have a band and we would perform, that was something that happened for me. As soon as I started singing, everything else melted away. And that's when I first started learning what that was, because I kept thinking, I want more of that, and I can't sing 24/7. You know?
In the zone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Gardening.
Right. Well, and what you're talking about there is, and I was, thank you, your segue is perfect, Brad, and that is life as meditation. You know, when I got introduced to meditation, I got introduced to guided meditation, and then it kind of got led into where I was being invited to learn how to do, to sit in silence. And in the beginning, the silence for me was just nothing but torment. I mean, the committee just had a ball. Oh my God. And, but at the same time, I recognized that that's what I was wanting to quiet. And I knew it was about discipline. It was about practice. It was anything. Anytime I wanted to learn anything with music, it took discipline. It took practicing the same thing every day. It's like, you know, I don't expect to become a virtuoso on the violin by any stretch of the imagination. I do expect in a reasonable length of time to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star without a mistake. But the only way that's going to happen is if I practice, right? If I continually do it. Well, what emerged out of that silent meditation and out of that discipline was recognizing that when things like when I was in my art room and I was doing, I was painting or I was doing beadwork or I was doing something like that, I noticed I was having that same kind of experience. I was totally focused on one thing. And so I was totally present, and that all the mind stuff stopped. It was gone. So then I began to realize, why can't that happen when I'm vacuuming, when I'm doing the dishes, when I'm sweeping the front porch, when I'm folding laundry, you know, when I'm washing a toilet? It's all the same thing. Can I focus in on just that task? And it is absolutely the most amazing experience. Washing dishes is absolute joy for me because I love the feel. I love to be able to feel the warmth of the water, the suds. I get to watch this dish go from this condition to this condition, you know. I'll help you learn how to do it. And that's where the discipline comes in. No, right now, just say, I noticed that. So you don't want to fight it. You don't want to push the ego away. Trust me, I've done all that. You know, I'm teaching you guys out of everything I've struggled with and what I continue to need to learn. So, you know, I've done that. And pushing the ego away just makes it stronger. It just comes back more. So it's just notice it. Just go, yeah, I notice. I'm, you know, they'll have to be dried or whatever. But right now, this is what I'm doing. Right now, I'm a woman standing at the sink washing dishes.
Come back.
Come back. Come back. Keep coming back. I talked about, we were talking about, oh, that was Marshall Rosenberg stuff when it was to not ever do anything that didn't bring you joy. And everybody went into this sort of mini panic. Nothing will get done. And I talked about how, you know, I hated cleaning toilets. And, you know, I cleaned houses to put myself through school. So I really, you know, my ego wants to let you know that it has a righteous reason for not liking to clean toilets, which really has absolutely no importance to it at all, or relevance. But what happened was, and what changed that for me, was when I was in Indonesia, and I needed to use the restroom, and we were way out in the middle of nowhere, and we found this little gas station. And so I was hoping they had a rest. Oh, yes, we have restroom. Building over there. So I go, and it's this solid, square, cement building. No windows, tin roof, one door. So I thought, okay, you know, I open the door. There's nothing in there. There is a concrete floor, but in the corner, it's been chiseled out and kind of dug out, and that's where you're supposed to go to the bathroom. So, you know, having waited entirely too long to go, I'm feeling like I don't have a lot of choice. So I walk over there, and they have their bugs and plants are bigger than their people. I have a picture of a friend of mine who stands about 5'7", 5'8", and she is standing next to this one leaf that is hanging down. And the leaf is bigger than her entire body, width and height. I mean, it was just everywhere. It was, and their bugs are enormous. Okay. So I get over there, and there is a cockroach, I swear to God, that is that big. And I stomped my foot on the floor thinking it would scurry away. That's been my experience in the States. it not only hissed at me, it flew at me. I tell you, I have such gratitude, for washing toilets today. It's all a matter of perspective, right? Okay? So when you're doing that task that you don't like, there's an exercise for you to let go. To surrender into it. One, admit, I have a choice. I don't have to do this. Everything's a choice. My grandma used to say that the only thing we ever had to do was to pay taxes and die. And when I was in high school, I said, Grandma, I've thought about that a lot, and the only thing we ever really have to do is die. Well, no, you'll go to prison if you don't pay your taxes. I said, well, then that's my choice, isn't it? I don't have to pay my taxes, though. That's still a choice. Do I want to deal with the consequences? What makes me feel better? Clean toilets? Yeah. So there, practice with those little things, because really, believe it or not, you think that sounds little. If you can get yourself in a state of acceptance and gratitude from surrendering, from letting go, from cleaning the toilet, raking the leaves, having to change the oil in your car, having to wash dishes, having to do any task that to you you've never liked doing. You've always hated it. Can't stand to do laundry. I hate laundry, which isn't true for me, but I've heard plenty of people say that. Let that be your experience of working on letting go. Can I let this go right now? Can I have full acceptance that this is what I'm doing in this moment? I'm sorting these clothes. Or I'm putting soap in the toilet and using the scrub brush and I'm scrubbing the toilet. And then to ask yourself, what is there about this I could have gratitude about? Well, I got a toilet to scrub. And water. I obviously could afford the soap and the brush, right? I don't have to fight big cockroaches. Well, what is anticipation? Where are you? Bingo. You're in the future. And the ego wants you there because it can survive. It's getting fed. And all the feelings that you were talking about and the emotions, most of that truly is about the pain body, what Tolle refers to as the pain body. And it's a separate energy that we feed off of by staying in our thinking about the way things should have been, the way this shouldn't have happened, that shouldn't have happened, all of that. So if you get out of your head, stop the thinking, and that's where Byron Katie's work comes in, because a lot of thoughts are not so easy to stop. So you get them down on paper and you take them through the work. That's different.
My ego does not want that. My ego wants me to go through some kind of process, addiction, or some.
Okay, so let me share this with you. Well, it wants you to feel comfortable, right? It wants you to be in a place where it's in control. So me, well, and at times it does. People that are addicted to crisis and drama, they love that discomfort. Is it real discomfort? No. No. It's all created up here. We create everything up here. Bruce Lipton and his colleague, and I mean, it is unbelievable what is getting proven scientifically today. They know for a fact now, and they and I just, God, I wish this was like on front page news, but of course that's never going to happen. Pharmaceutical companies will no longer test new drugs up against placebos. You know why? How do placebos work? It's all up here. Because your belief is, I'm a doctor or I'm a scientist, and I'm saying, here, this drug will take the pain away from your arthritis. Right? And so you believe you're getting, oh, I'm getting a drug that will do this. And the mind kicks in. The mind doesn't know the difference between real and imaginary. It has no clue. And it doesn't really care, frankly. So the reason they stopped testing drugs against pharmaceutical or placebos is because placebos went out every time with no side effects. Every time. Every time. That's how powerful our mind is. I know you've all heard that we only use like 10% of our brain, right? What do you think that is? It's the mind. It's the power that we have to make something real. Some of you have seen The Secret. You've played a little bit with the idea of the law of attraction. A lot of people struggle with it because they aren't really... There's a lot behind it. There's a lot more behind it than what you saw in a 90-minute film. But it really is about the power of the mind. So the mind, when it... And the ego, when it goes up there and it's saying, this shouldn't have happened, she shouldn't have left me, he shouldn't have died, they shouldn't have done this. Well, we can get all kinds of drama around that. And that's why, for example, I was saying, I'll argue with anybody around, well, I won't, but, you know, for me, there's no truth in it. There's no reality in the statement that if you lose a really close loved one, it takes 3 to 5 years to do the grief. Because I've lost close loved ones over the years. And I've just recently gone through that again. And what I know to be true from my own personal experience is that when I go up here and I listen to all my thinking and I listen to what the ego wants me to do and believe, and it bounces to the past, oh, I should have done this, so there's guilt and there's shame and there's all this stuff, and then it bounces into the future and, oh, I'll never be able to see her again and I'll never be able to talk to her again and that shouldn't have happened and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm having emotional reactions to my thinking. So I think, because I've been told by everyone around me, my culture, that I'm grieving. Because I'm crying and I'm upset all the time and I can't eat and I don't sleep and, you know, I go through all this high drama that takes years, and yet most people then will end up in therapy because they're stuck in the depression or the anger stages of grief. And I love, don't get me wrong, I love Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, but her stages of grief were all based on what goes on up here, the thinking. You dropped into the true feeling. You dropped into what is true grief. So when we're not up here, it doesn't mean we're not going to have feelings. And you're right. This is what the ego doesn't want to connect with. Because that's real, and it's what's in this moment. And then that's when it wants to go into process addictions and substance addictions and anything. Go anywhere. You know? Yeah. Any way possible. Absolutely. But when you do grief in that fashion, it moves so much more quickly. It moves so much more quickly. I worked with a woman who, and some of you have heard me talk about this in here, her 2-year-old son had died of cancer. And she heard that I facilitated Byron Katie's work. And she knew that taking her beliefs and her thoughts about that through that process would relieve a lot of her pain, because she wanted to get down into the real grief of what was happening and not be stuck up here for years. For one thing, she said, I've got 2 other children at home. and I'm not there for them at all. So we took a couple of thoughts through the work, but what it really boiled down to was her belief that parents shouldn't ever have to bury their children. And towards the end of it, where we got was parents should have to bury their children. Where's the evidence? She buried her 2-year-old child. And then what she was able to do was, and she started to cry, and I could tell there's a difference. There's a difference from the tears that happen when you're stuck up here listening to this, and a difference of what when the tears are coming from here. And I asked her, where are you feeling it in your body? And she said, right here in my heart. And I said, can you close your eyes and just go in and be with that and allow the tears to come, but just be with that and stay out of any more thoughts that come up. And she probably sobbed for about 40 minutes. And I just held space. I was just there as a witness. She didn't need me to do anything. And when she was done, she said she felt better. And, you know, we usually always feel a little better after a good cry, right? I asked her, I didn't know this, I asked her, how long ago did your son die? And I'm figuring I'm going to hear, for some reason I had it in my head, 18 months, 2 years, 2 months. It had just happened 60 days before she came to see me. What I have heard from her since, and what I have continued to hear from her, because she stays in touch with me, is her biggest issue now is that family and friends keep telling her she's not doing her grief. Because she's done. She is so at peace with it. And she's so present with her other 2 children. And it's just the most beautiful thing I've ever witnessed. I would go to her if I lost one of my grandchildren at that young of an age. I would go to her and say, walk me through that process. Because I want what you have. I would very much like to be able to do what she did with it. I'd love to be able to say I could. I don't know if I can. I don't know any of that until I've gone through it. But what I'm trying to explain is that that's the real feeling, and it's surrendering into that, the acceptance of this is. This has broken me open in a place that is causing pain without even having to go up here for any reason. And that with that, being a human being, tears come with that pain. But when I go in and I sit with that, like what you described, when you dropped down into present moment, got in here and felt the real loss without any thinking going on, that was real. Yeah, and the ego doesn't want that because you were present. Not because of the emotion, because of being present. It wouldn't mind all the drama if you were doing the drama out of past or future, and because then it can get attention, it can get sympathy, it can, you know, all that stuff that we get addicted. I mean, those are addictions too. You know, love, approval, and appreciation. We get addicted to that. But that's another circle. Which I've taught on. But sometimes this stuff just needs to keep recycling, doesn't it? So.
If someone told me, I have the family, and now I understand why I said it. He said, no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, if that comes over you,
Allow it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there are times, like if I'm sitting with a client, it really isn't the most appropriate time for me to allow the grief to go through me as I'm sitting with that person, you know. But in that in that space, I still am able to say, now is not the time because I can't give full attention to you. I'm in present moment and my attention is focused here. So it's not that I push it away or dismiss it or, you know, avoid it. It's, you know, wait another 30 minutes, you know, and if the wave is still there, and it usually is, because all you have to do, like what you did, what you experienced, you dropped down into your heart center. You got present. And there it was. Yeah. Yeah, it does. It really does. It's a huge gift. Yeah. So, if I were to give you homework, it would be, look at those tasks, those daily tasks. Maybe it's getting up in the morning. Maybe it's going to work out at the gym. Maybe it's, you know, whatever it is, you know, a household chore. Maybe it's going to talk to somebody that you don't want to talk to at work. You just don't like them. And then remind yourself, oh, here's my opportunity. Can be fully present with this person. Maybe be a little quieter than I normally would be and listen. You know? Listen. Really hear what that person is saying. Try to understand what need are they trying to get met. Now I'm bouncing into Marshall Rosenberg's work. Because his focus with everybody all the time is what are they feeling and what need are they trying to get met. That we don't do anything that we aren't trying to get a need met. It's just that most of the time, most of our strategies suck. They're self-destructive, they hurt other people, you know, they don't work because we don't really get the need met, you know. But he is this incredible guy that created this whole language, and he's Jewish, and he stood in front of a whole group of us and said, Hitler was just trying to get needs met. Now, nobody else could have gotten away with that but somebody who was Jewish in our politically correct climate. But he was. It was the truth. And then he went through the history of what happened during World War I, where Germany was left at, you know, what the people were, you know, he said. And then he played the role of Hitler. And he said, so what needs was he trying to get met? So yeah, his strategy really sucked. But don't most of ours? You know, have they really gotten our needs met? So when you're listening to that person and you're trying to practice that letting go and that surrendering with that person at work, say, that you don't care for, listen to them with a fresh ear. What need are they trying to get met? And, you know, and it's okay if the first time you experience this, you fall down and it doesn't work and you end up in a big argument with them and you end up calling them names or whatever, you know. Surrender into that. Let it go and surrender into that. Yep, that's what I did. Yep, and then I had to make amends. Yeah, and making amends is about letting go, isn't it? Yeah, it's one level of it, one layer. So,
is it okay just to be direct with people and say, what do you need?
Mm-hmm. Or is it? Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, a book called The Celestine Prophecies, if any of you are familiar with it, he talks about the four control dramas in there. And he talks about there's the intimidator, the interrogator, the poor me, and the aloof. And that they're all different ways, basically, of trying to get energy from other people to sustain self. So that's getting a need met. Dysfunctionally, you know, it's a poor strategy. And he gives some examples in there. Well, I saw, oh, and I'm not going to remember this. It's been too long, I think. I saw a movie with Jodie Foster, and it was depicting a real story where she'd been gang raped in a tavern, and it was all about the legal end of it. And there was one young man who had witnessed what happened and had not participated, and at first he was going to testify for the prosecution against the guys. And then his attorney got a hold of the prosecuting attorney and said, no, that's not going to happen. And Jodie Foster, as the victim in the role she was playing, was there, and she was furious. And the two attorneys decided to step outside and talk. So that left Jodie Foster, who was playing the role of the victim, and this young man who had witnessed everything in the room together. And what I got to watch was what James Redfield talks about in that book, about that control thing, and where he did. And he talks in the book about coming right out and basically asking, what do you need or what are you afraid of? So that's basically, she was furious, she was chewing him out, she was, you know, giving him a piece of her mind, and she just stopped and she sat down and she said, what are you afraid of? Which is essentially the same kind of thing. What do you need? And being that she put the truth on the table, that he was experiencing fear, he immediately was able to go there and talk with her about it. And through that process, he was able to get his need met in a much more appropriate way, and he ended up testifying. But absolutely, that your question brought all of that to mind just then. Because when you go directly say, what is it that you need? The only trouble is, most people don't know. And that's why it's so important to get familiar with the difference between, and this is where Rosenberg teaches this, and I teach a class on it too, and I don't know when it's cycling back around. It'll be around here again pretty soon. But on nonviolent communication, because it's about learning the difference between universal needs and pseudo needs, what he calls pseudo needs. So a universal need is love. Okay? And this is Rosenberg stuff. So a pseudo need is, I need you to love me. That's a pseudo need. Because it's true that I need love. That's a basic human need. It is not true that I need any particular individual to receive that from. We just believe we do, and that's where we get stuck in that. And that's ego, and then we can trip off into Tolle stuff and Katie stuff. And I mean, it all just dovetails beautifully together. But if you can get familiar with what the universal needs are, you might ask somebody instead, are you feeling frightened because your need for safety might not get met? But then you have to learn what all those universal needs are so that when you're listening to that person, you can identify. We have just a lot of ghosties that want to join us. So, yeah. But that's putting it right on the table then. Yeah. And that's in the case that I was talking about where you end up in a fight with a coworker, say, for example. What he talks about is we learn to listen with giraffe ears rather than jackal ears. And we learn to speak giraffe rather than jackal, and that's how he talks about it. But that's a whole nother, I mean, we could be here till 6 o'clock in the morning on that and just break ground. So, okay. I'm paying attention to the time. Announcements. I got a lot of them here. Next week, we usually go every other week because it's the first and third Wednesday of the month, but it's also the fifth Wednesday if there is one. Well, today's the fifth Wednesday. So that means we don't skip a week because next Wednesday is the first Wednesday. So we will be here next Wednesday, 6:30. And in 2 weeks, on March 14th, Todd, some of you have met him, will be facilitating the Byron Katie group, and that he does on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month, and that's across the street at my house. And if you want to be on the email list, if you're not, you will get a reminder of that. So that's available to you to learn her work. And he's an awesome facilitator, and he teaches it really, really well. So it is really worth your time and effort to do that. Saturday the 17th, so I don't know how far off that is. 3 weeks? Almost 2.5 weeks, right? Yeah, 2.5 weeks. I'm teaching the intuition workshop, and that's just getting you back in touch with one of your birthright. I mean, it's just another sense, like your ability to see and hear and taste and feel and smell. Yeah, there's flyers over there on that. April 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th, Tom Compton, who is internationally known. He has taught all over the world Byron Katie's work, and is was the director of her school for 5 years, now is and has been out on his own for a long time. He will be doing, we have brought him here to Vancouver. And we'll, in fact, we'll be in this building. We'll be at the other end at the, in the bigger room in Bradford Hall. And there's flyers over there on that. So you can get the flyers on that and the information for that. Oh, and by the way, the intuition workshop, if some of you were here 2 weeks ago and picked up the intuition workshop, the date was the 10th, March 10th, and that had to change because of a commitment that I failed to write in my calendar. So it's the 17th. And also just somebody told me this the other day, Karen, you need to let people know that you do this work. For those of you who don't know or and that may be interested, I do healing touch and Reiki and matrix energetics works that help with physical problems, emotional issues. I mean, it's pretty phenomenal stuff. So I got asked to announce that, so there I did. And I keep meaning to do this, but I get into such a zone sometimes that it just isn't like here, so I made myself a big note. I want to thank Adam and Lisa for coming here every circle and helping to set up and helping to break down. And Adam rides his bicycle here. I just think that's awesome. So thank you very much, both of you. Yeah. Okay, and I think that's it. So, I want to read this in closing, or almost closing. This is written also by Ernest Holmes, and it's called She Let Go. She let go, without a thought or a word. She let go. She let go of the fear. She let go of the judgments. She let go of the confluence of opinions swarming around her head. She let go of the committee of indecision within her. She let go of all the right reasons. Wholly and completely, without hesitation or worry, she just let go. She didn't ask anyone for advice. She didn't read a book on how to let go. She didn't search the scriptures. She just let go. She let go of all the memories that held her back. She let go of all the anxiety that kept her from moving forward. She let go of the planning and all of the calculations about how to do it just right. She didn't promise to let go. She didn't journal about it. She didn't write the projected date in her day timer. She made no public announcement and put no ad in the paper. She didn't check the weather report or read her daily horoscope. She just let go. She didn't analyze whether she should let go. She didn't call her friends to discuss the matter. She didn't do a 5-step spiritual mind treatment. She didn't call the prayer line. She didn't utter one word. She just let go. No one was around when it happened. There was no applause or congratulations. No one thanked her or praised her. No one noticed a thing. like a leaf falling from a tree, she just let go. There was no effort. There was no struggle. It wasn't good, and it wasn't bad. It was what it was, and it is just that. In the space of letting go, she let it all be. A small smile came over her face. A light breeze blew through her, and the sun and the moon shone forevermore. She just let go. And in closing, when you surrender to what is, and so become fully present, the past ceases to have any power. The realm of being, which had been obscured by the mind, then opens up. Suddenly a great stillness arises within you, an unfathomable sense of peace. And within that peace, there is great joy. And within that joy, there is love. And at the innermost core, there is the sacred, the immeasurable, that which cannot be named. Thank you all very much for coming.